Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. Visualize a small business. It occupies one room, serves tea, coffee, and pastries, and sells books in a range of magazines, from Time to Gentleman's Quarterly. There are chairs and couches for reading and conversation, and in the small yard outside, rich in tropical plants, are tables and chairs, a bench, even a hammock. A mixed-color, curly-haired terrier, Toby, wags a greeting from the open door. Walking by on the sidewalk, you get the feeling it would be a nice place to relax for 10 minutes or an hour. You won't be overly surprised that the manager, Connor Gorey, is from New York. You will be surprised that the store, called Cuba Libro, is in Havana, Cuba. Connor Gorey, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thanks, Brian, and buenas noches from Havana to all your listeners.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in New York, born and bred. My parents divorced when I was 3. I was brought up by my mom, single mother of 4.
Looking back on that period of time, let's say from the time that you were an infant till you went to high school, what key values did you learn that stick with you now?
My mom instilled in me 2 key concepts that I hold dear to me to this day. One was live your dreams. The other one was that money is good for 3 things: travel, health, and education. I'm still paying off student loans. I'm still traveling. Luckily, I'm pretty healthy, so I haven't had to spend much on that. But I've taken them to heart, and here I am in Havana.
Well, you mentioned education. Tell us about it.
I got an undergraduate degree from New York University in Latin American Studies. At the time, everyone thought I was crazy. What will you do with a degree in Latin American Studies? I didn't know.
When you say at the time, what time was that time?
That was in the mid-80s.
Okay.
I graduated in 1991.
Okay, I interrupted you. You didn't know what you were going to do with it, but you took it anyway. Latin American Studies. Any sense of why?
Latin American Studies?
Yes.
We were standing in my kitchen, probably getting drunk, as we tend to do in my family, stand in the kitchen and have some cocktails, and Mom was looking at the syllabus. I was a sophomore in college. I remember it quite clearly. She was looking at the syllabus and said, that looks interesting. Brazilian fiction in translation. I knew nothing about Brazilian fiction. I knew nothing about Brazil. I said, that looks interesting. I'll take that course. And from that day, I was hooked. Magic realism, all the great South American writers, and I ended up getting a degree in Latin American Studies and then a master's degree in political science.
In that educational process, did you learn Spanish?
I did learn Spanish. I was traveling quite a bit still when I was in college and learning on the road kind of Spanish, traveler's Spanish, where's the bathroom, trying to get food, things of that nature, and took some courses at NYU in Spanish. When I went to graduate school, I specifically chose a school that required half of your coursework in Spanish. Languages are not my strong point, and I knew I would blow it off if I didn't. And it served me quite well. And today, Cubans tell me I speak a la cubana.
How did you get to Cuba, and when?
On a plane, haha. That's the big joke. It's a long story. I'm writing the story right now. I first came in 1993. It was the special period in Cuba, when Cuba lost 85% of its aid in trade.
The Soviet Union had collapsed.
Soviet Union collapsed. Rug was pulled out from under Cuba. Average adult lost 15 pounds. There were 16-hour blackouts daily. Transport was virtually non-existent. Cuba imported 1 million bicycles so people could get around and get to work and get to school. And I was doing a master's in political science, writing my thesis on the embargo, and I wanted to see what this weird place 90 miles from our shores was really like. I heard people talking about Cuba. I was reading about Cuba in the newspapers, and I thought, the best experience is to experience it firsthand. So I came here with the American Friends Service Committee, excellent organization, and I was here for a month volunteering in 1993. I saw people going to work, having parties, making babies, studying, and enjoying life in spite of the intense hardship and struggle that they were facing. And I thought, here's a society that has something really special going for it, the Cuban people. They've got a spirit that's indomitable. And I wanted to learn more about that.
What was your work during that month with the American Friends Service Committee?
Intense. It was August. Temperatures here get to be unbearably hot in August, 100% humidity. We were working in the fields. I was working alongside Cubans. We would wake up at 5:30 in the morning with blasting salsa music, accompanied by a trumpet, and we would be trucked into the fields. We would have, I think for breakfast, it was coffee and a piece of bread. We'd go into the fields. We were cleaning the fields from the past harvest of boniato, which is sweet potato. And we would work under that brutal sun until about midday, with the only thing that we had to eat during that time was good-looking, swarthy young men would pass each row with a tin cup of sugar water. And we would drink that until noon when the truck would come and get us. We'd go back for lunch, take a siesta, and then go back out into the fields until sundown.
That sounds like a hell of a trip. Why would you want to come back?
Did I mention the swarthy young men there?
Oh, I see. Okay, tell me about the swarthy young men. These are attractive people.
It was actually, you know, here we are having only sugar water to sustain us through the hot day, and we would be singing, making jokes, making conversation, learning about each other, and then at night, again, singing, guitars would be busted out, and having a good time until we woke up the next morning. And it really inspired me to see people enjoying life to its fullest in spite of their hardship. And I wanted to try to understand what drove people to be that selfless, because of course we were harvesting fields for the consumption of the population. It wasn't easy coming back. It was hard to travel to Cuba at that time. I had had a wild love affair with a Cuban while I was here. We lost contact for 8 years, from 1993 until 2001. We reconnected by chance through a mutual friend in 2001. This gentleman was in the United States doing a speaking tour around universities in the U.S. We reconnected, started falling in love. I moved back here. We got married, and that was in 2002, and I've been here ever since.
Before we discuss your experience over the last 12 years, let me go back to this, quote, special period that Cuba had, a very difficult time. You describe an atmosphere of shared hardship, joy, music, friendships, whatever. I think for most Americans, their image of Cuba as a communist state wouldn't fit that, okay? Would you agree?
I would agree.
Okay. First, how did it strike you? Did it surprise you to run into that set of cultural characteristics, politics aside?
I had known Cubans in the United States, so I knew a bit of how fun-loving they were, etc. But it surprised me in the fact that I come from New York. It's a rat race. It's a society that's organized around how much money you make. You go to a cocktail party, the first question you're asked is, what do you do? In Cuba, the first question you're asked at a cocktail party is, do you have family? Do you have kids? That was much more within my value system. Okay. And so it kind of just meshed with how I was brought up.
Did it surprise you, was my question?
No.
Because of your earlier experience with Cubans?
Yes.
Okay. And what would you say to Americans that say, this doesn't sound real?
Come on down. Don't believe me. Draw your own conclusions. Now that the U.S. and Cuba are moving towards normalized relations, it'll be easier than ever. And don't believe me. Don't believe your friends. Don't believe the newspaper. Come on down and see for yourself.
Before I forget, if they do come down, what's the address of your store?
It's on the corner of Calle, which means street in Spanish, 24. And Calle 19, right on the corner, in Vedalo, which is a very hip-happening area of Havana.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Connor Gorey of Havana, Cuba. At the top of the show, I described the business that you manage, but that's not your main work. What is?
I'm a health journalist. I'm an accredited journalist here with the International Press Center. I write for a scientific peer-reviewed journal called Medic Review. It's dedicated to health, Cuban health and medicine.
Okay, that's an interesting concept. I'm not quite sure what it means. What do you end up writing about in specific terms?
For instance, for the next issue, I'm writing about Cuba's infant mortality rate. It's the lowest rate in history that the Cubans have recorded. I've written about breast milk banks. I've written about disaster relief medicine. I've traveled with the brigades overseas in post-disaster situations.
When you say the brigades, you're talking about Cuban medical groups?
Yes, and the Henry Reeve Brigade, which your listeners might have heard, are in West Africa right now, the biggest contingent of a single country doctor relief team is from Cuba, fighting Ebola in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea.
How long have you been a journalist, and have you been doing this from the outset?
I wasn't a journalist before I came to Cuba. I was a freelance writer. I wrote guidebooks for Lonely Planet. I learned on the job. I'm very much a journey woman in the sense that medical education cooperation with Cuba, needed a journalist, and I was around for the job. So I learned about the health system and about covering the health system while being an editor and a journalist for this journal.
Medical care is a concept, but it involves human beings. Can you give me an example of your exposure to that sort of aspect of the work you're doing?
Sure. When I was in Pakistan with the Cuban Brigade after the 2005 earthquake, I was called upon often in the tents where they're delivering primary care to translate for the Cuban doctors. In Pakistan, many people speak English, and they would ask me to translate and say, "Connor, can you help us translate this? We're trying to diagnose this woman." And I wouldn't understand the Pakistani English. I had a very hard time, and I would turn to the Cubans and say, "I can't understand what they're saying either." I can remember once also that I was in an operating room where they were amputating a toe. And I was photographing and I was taking notes. I was going to cover the story about this post-disaster care that the Cubans were giving to Pakistanis. And I started smelling the burning toe. They were cauterizing the toe. And the surgeon turned to me and said, "Connor, grab that bucket." And so I was forced into action to grab the bucket so they could saw off the toe. It was a diabetic toe, and get it into the bucket. And so in many situations in Haiti and Pakistan and things like that, you're called to, you might be reporting, but you're on the ground, you're helping heal people at the same time that you're covering the story.
As I said at the top of the show, that bookstore that you manage is not exactly what I've been here six times now, expected to walk by in the neighborhood where I stay at a bed and breakfast. Where did the idea come from?
The idea came from a big bag of books that a friend of mine called me up one day and said, "I've got a big bag of books. They're good books. They're not great books. I don't have room in my house. Will you take them?" And as a writer, I can't throw out a book. She brought over the sack of books. I looked at it for 6 months, and I cooked up the idea for Cuba Libro.
All right, cooking up an idea for a business and making a business is not a simple thing. I'm thinking of the United States and the small business people we've interviewed. So take us through the process. This is a Communist Party government. You're an American. You're talking about just from sitting and looking at the bookcase, there's a book on Henry Aaron, there's a book on David Brinkley. I mentioned Time Magazine, Gentleman's Quarterly. These are not party books, party line books. So there are some issues I want to explore. But first, let's start with the administrative apparatus. How tough to start a business?
It's actually very simple. You need a lot of patience. There's a lot of waiting in line. That is probably right how your listeners imagine a communist country. And you have to wait in line to get the permits. We have permits to buy and sell used books, and we have permits to sell non-alcoholic beverages. To sell any kind of food or drink in Cuba, you need a health department clearance that requires full blood work, HIV tests, 3 fecal samples to be able to get the approval, the hygienic approval, to be able to serve food and drink. We did that. We had to go to urban planning to get approval for our signage, the name of the business, and had to pay, I think it was about $5 was to take out all of the permits.
Now, this all happened When? How many years ago?
I started the process in May of 2013, and we opened in August of 2013.
Okay. That's a period prior to the announcement by the two presidents in December of 2014 of normalization of relations. And I think it's fair to describe the political relationship of the governments as not friendly during that time. Here's an American going to manage a business, run into any political suspicion? A. B. Does anybody monitor what books you're selling?
I'll take B first. I don't think so. Cubans are pretty clever. If anyone's monitoring me, I don't think I would know.
Okay.
The political resistance, it came not from any kind of government apparatus. It came more from neighbors. Suspicious. Who is this person? They're opening a business in our neighborhood. They don't live in our neighborhood. They're foreign. What's going on in there?
How did that express itself and where? To you directly, to the authorities? How'd you hear about it?
A short story. We at Cuba Libro, I'm very dedicated to HIV prevention, so we distribute free condoms. We've distributed over 3,500 condoms since we've opened, and we have a basket there for people who want to come in and take condoms. Cuba Libro is open to people of all ages. We have activities for all types of people, and the school kids, we're across the street from a school. They like to come in and play in the hammocks and play around the store. And one day, I noticed that there were six girls in their school uniforms around the condom basket.
And how old are we talking about?
Probably 8 years old.
Pretty young for condoms.
Yes. So I went up to them and I said, look, girls, you're welcome to play anywhere in Cuba Libro, but these are for adults. This is a public health service that we provide, so please step away from there and play someplace else. 2 days later, the director of the school came in and said, we have a report from parents that you're giving out condoms to children. And that was how I learned that some of the girls stole some condoms and took them home. Their parents found them, and they said, the foreign lady is giving out condoms.
Right.
And so it was a process of educating the community, the families, please come into Cuba Libro, see what we're doing. This is part of my public health advocacy. My brother died of HIV. I'm very dedicated to HIV prevention. I told the girls not to take the condoms. And it's one of those things that gossip is the national sport in Cuba. It spun way out of control. But once I spoke with the director of the school and spoke with the parents and they saw what we were doing, now we have full support of the community.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Connor Gorey, who manages a bookstore in Havana, Cuba. Now, if I imagine that same story taking place in Montana or in many, many parts of the United States, a foreigner, quote-unquote, even though you've lived here for 10 years.
13.
Okay. Not sure the ending ends up the same. Did the authorities get involved at all?
No, they didn't. And I had some folks come in and say, this would never happen in France, for instance. And it was
never
just,
happen in what respect?
That the parents would get upset that the children had condoms. Whoa. The fact is that once Cubans get to know you and once you start the conversation, they lower their suspicion and the paranoia dissipates. And it took a process of many months of community projects and community cleanups and planting trees, and they saw that we were doing good and giving back, and slowly but surely people came to support us and now are part of the Cuba Libro family.
Giving back is a phrase I've heard fairly often in terms of our interviews. What do you mean?
What I'm seeing in Cuba today is a society that is undergoing economic changes where private business owners have the opportunities with a little bit of savvy and investment to make a lot of money. But what happens when that money doesn't get funneled back into the community? Are we just going to turn into another third world capital? There are a lot of people working here to prevent that from happening. I count myself among them. I'm trying to do community projects. pay a decent salary over and above what other people pay, profit-sharing scheme for our work staff, and trying to provide young Cubans, above all, because out-emigration is one of our greatest problems here, trying to provide them the tools so that they can dream and they can expand their horizons and they can be participating in a project where they see their lives getting better. For example, the young fellow that's been working at Cuba Libre since the beginning helped paint, started out painting the interior, and now is kind of secondhand man, I guess, at Cuba Libre. Douglas had always dreamed of having an iPhone. That was his dream. He also dreams of traveling. He dreams of living in London. So the first thing he bought from his profit-sharing scheme was an iPhone, and although it seems like something silly, maybe, to people who hear about human rights and these kinds of things in Cuba, what young people today are like young people everywhere. Cuban young people want electronics, they want to be connected, and he was able to make that happen. Now he's moving on to getting a passport and dreaming about travel, and the salary that's provided is helping him do that.
Prior to the interview, you told me that you were involved in starting something that I will call socially responsible business. It's not the exact title. Tell us about it.
This is a concept. It's not new. They've been working on this in Cuba. Old Havana has got a network happening, a nascent network of socially and ethically responsible businesses. But what's happening is the inequities today in Cuba between the people who are participating in the new economy, starting businesses, et cetera, and those who do not. We need to reconcile that somehow. We need to provide visitors the options to patronize businesses that give back to their local community. So we have certain projects that are designed and certain concepts in play at Cuba Libre to help address that.
Okay, when you say that, let me just rephrase this and see if I got it. 5 years ago, approximately, 98% of the people in Cuba worked for the government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, roughly 400,000 people out of a population of 11 million work for some form of private sector, including cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that the salaries in the private sector are significantly higher than the public sector salaries?
Yes, which is contributing to one of the problems today in society, which is internal brain drain, people leaving the state sector to work in the private sector.
Okay, just for example, for our listeners, you may remember when I first came to Cuba, I interviewed a cab driver who stopped his college studies because he could make much more money driving a cab multiple times than he could as a psychologist. So you point out a large problem, one being brain drained people leaving the country. Well, you said moving to the private sector. Another is they leave the country because they can make more money. How can business possibly, a small business, affects something like that in any meaningful way, or even a network of small businesses?
Right. Well, there are two issues at work. There's external brain drain, people leaving the country, which has been going on. We've been hemorrhaging young people for a long time here. The other one is internal brain drain, where people are leaving the state sector to start private businesses, doctors who start private restaurants, for instance, or teachers who start B&Bs.
Okay. What's the relevance of what you're talking about to that problem?
For instance, we have a donation project with the school that is across the street from Cuba Libre. The English teacher came to us when we first opened and said, I've got a problem in my classroom. Half of my children in the classroom have computers at home where they have English-Spanish dictionaries on their computers. Half of the students don't have computers at home, and we don't have any dictionaries. I'm the teacher, and I don't even have an English-Spanish dictionary. So we started a dictionary drive to donate English-Spanish dictionaries to that school so that the education system, state sector, would have the resources to be able to address inequities in the classroom so that the kids that have computers at home aren't having a leg up on the kids because of the luck of the draw, they don't have computers at home.
Okay, so that's an example of something that your business, the business you manage, has done to help a local school. You talk about a network. What kind of reception are you getting? And again, I want to put parenthesis, an American promoting a concept to other Cuban entrepreneurs. What's the reception?
The reception is great because the demand is on the consumer side. U.S. tourists come here and they want to patronize businesses that are giving back to the community. It's just like the ecotourism kind of idea where you want to give back, you want to patronize a business that has ecological philosophy underpinning its practice. So The U.S. folks that I've told about this network say, where's the list of businesses? We want to go to that private restaurant. We want to go to that B&B that is giving back to the community rather than one that is just lining the pockets of the owners.
I'm told this particular space has an unusual history. Can you tell us about it?
It's a fascinating history, and it's an important piece of cultural history in Cuba. This apartment was owned by Maito and Marucha, two photographers, vanguard photographers of street photography in Cuba in the 1980s. And it operated as a salon. All the cultural luminaries of the time would come through. They would jam after concerts. They would have big dinner parties. The photographers would develop their images in the back room, which is now our office. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Santiago Feliu, Silvio Rodriguez, Sidney Lumet, all of these people used to hang out in this apartment. And when we approached the owners to start up this crazy English language bookstore, they were very excited about the possibilities of recapturing that magic that happened here.
Is there memory in the neighborhood about that unusual history?
There are very clear memories. There's one story about Gabriel Garcia Marquez hanging out in the garden, right outside the door, and a motorcycle came by. And this is a busy intersection, and there was a woman with a sheet cake on the motorcycle. It was her twin's birthday. There was an accident. The cake fell. The woman was crying. She had saved up all of her money to buy this cake. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez very quietly picked up the phone, made a phone call, and within a half an hour, another sheet cake arrived, prettier than the original. And she never really knew how that sheet cake came to be, but the neighbors still talk about the story, Gabo and his sheet cake.
Finally, let me ask you this. The presidents of the two countries in December announced the intention to reestablish diplomatic relations after more than 50 years of rupture.
Woo-hoo!
I guess that expresses your opinion. What other thoughts do you have about it?
It is incredibly welcome. Every Cuban that you talked to on December 17th said, I didn't think I would live to see the day. And now the day has passed, and now it's time to make the sausage. As I say, the hard work begins. It's going to be a long, slow process. There's going to be a lot of legal, political, policy issues to work out, but it's extraordinarily refreshing to put that time behind us and try a new tack.
Connor Gorey, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for its content. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. Contact us at www.homegroundradio.org.